Stirring it up in Portland. Mary Starrett, True Talk 800 AM.
I'm only willing to hear you cry because I am an innocent man.
They say that the prisons are full of innocent people who say they didn't do it, but in Bernard Webster's case, he was telling the truth. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm glad you're joining us this afternoon here on True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Starrett. Bernard Webster went to prison for 20 years for a rape he didn't commit. But because of DNA technology, which wasn't available then, they were able to prove that not only didn't he do it, but were able to track down the man who allegedly did it. Bernard Webster is out of prison after 20 years, but Darren Powell is getting ready to be tried for that case. Here is a guy, Darren Powell, who is a registered sex offender with a lengthy criminal history, and there was a match earlier this week that showed that in all likelihood it was Darren Powell who committed this rape, the one that Bernard Webster went to prison for 20 years of his life for. Joining us now is a woman who's going to tell us how this could happen and how we can help those who are wrongly convicted. Her name is Michelle Nethercutt. She is the Chief of Forensics for the Maryland Office of the Public Defender and head of the Innocence Project with the Maryland Public Defender's Office. All right, we're having some technical problems. Hopefully she will get back on the line at any moment. But fortunately, there are people who will realize that at any given time, I mean, I've heard estimates that somewhere around 15% of the people who are serving time are in there who shouldn't be there, whether they've been wrongly convicted based on evidence, which is, you know, was it eyewitnesses, whatever. But there are people who shouldn't be in prison. Now, you know, we've talked about this before on the program. But Monday, they were able to get a match on this Darren Powell, who has a number of drug convictions, according to court records. He was convicted of first-degree rape 6 years after Bernard Webster started to serve a 30-year sentence. He was serving a 30-year sentence, and 20 years of it went by before the Innocence Project was able to prove that he didn't do it. I hope we have Michelle on the line now. Michelle, are you there?
Hi.
Glad to have you here. I was introducing you as the Chief of Forensics for the Maryland Office of the Public Defender and the head of the Innocence Project office in the Office of the Maryland Public Defender. I'm so glad that you're here to tell this story.
Sure.
Tell me how you first came to know about Bernard Webster.
I first came to know about him because he wrote me a letter. He actually wrote me several letters. And he'd actually written to a number of people, and he wrote to me, apparently because he saw my name in the newspaper in connection with some kind of issue around DNA. So he wrote to me, and his communications were always really quite short and to the point, basically just said that he was serving time for a crime that he did not commit, that he wanted to have the DNA testing performed. He had read about DNA testing, and he was confident that if something could be tested, that it would prove his innocence.
Yeah, but I'm sure you get lots of letters, Michelle, from people who say, I didn't do it. What made this one stand out?
Well, I don't know that part of the, he was sentenced to a term of 30 years incarceration, and he was writing me when he was pretty close to reaching his mandatory release date. In fact, his mandatory release date was February, just a couple of months from when he ultimately obtained his release as a result of the exoneration. The fact that he had been pursuing this as to the extent that he had made me think that there was certainly certainly something that was worth at least looking into. And to be perfectly honest, I thought the chances of locating evidence, given the length of the age of the case, was extremely unlikely. But I was curious enough that I made some phone calls, and the police had not retained any of the evidence, but I was ultimately able to track down the evidence at the hospital and do the testing. So basically, it was just the directness of his communications and the fact that he had been so persistent about it, and the fact that it wasn't really a situation where this was someone who was facing, you know, the rest of their life in prison and had nothing to lose by, you know, sending people on wild goose chases.
Mm-hmm.
And my, you know, interactions with him just suggested to me that he was direct, and he appeared quite trustworthy.
How could something like this happen?
How could it happen?
How can, you know, we think that our system of, you know, that it's got so many fail safes, that how could somebody go to prison for 20 years for something he didn't do?
Well, that's the thing I think that's so scary about this case, because it is not a case in which, I mean, it's a case in which really the system basically worked as it is designed and intended to. And what I mean by that is it's not a case where there was some, you know, someone who made some sort of a police officer or a law enforcement official who did something shady or, you know, engaged in any sort of misconduct. There's nothing to indicate that. What happened is just really a series of unfortunate and ultimately really tragic errors. There were three eyewitnesses who basically made an incorrect eyewitness identification. That alone would be sufficient, you know, was sufficient then, is sufficient now to sentence people, you know, for any type of crime, I mean, including murder for that matter. So part of this comes down to, has to do with the nature of eyewitness testimony, which we tend to think is just, you know, there's a long history of eyewitness testimony really being afforded a kind of special imprimatur that some people tend to think of it as somehow much more convincing, say, than circumstantial evidence. The problem is that there are a lot of problems with eyewitness identification, as this case and many, many others around the country have indicated. It's often mistaken. And eyewitness identification in certainly Maryland and in many other states, one eyewitness identifying someone as the perpetrator of a crime is sufficient to convict them.
So in Bernard Webster's case, you were able to get a hold of some DNA, which is, it's not usual that this evidence is kept for a number of years, is it?
No, it's not. And again, it was not kept by the police department. The police department had destroyed the evidence long ago. It was just fortunate for Mr. Webster that the hospital had retained it, because the victim of the crime had been examined in the emergency room at the Greater Baltimore Medical Center, which at that time was a designated sexual assault examination facility. In other words, they had an arrangement with Baltimore County where victims of sex offenses were taken and given medical treatment there. And also, there was, you know, samples taken for forensic evaluation, and that's what was done in this case. And it was the hospital that had retained these slides for all these years.
It's sort of a naive assumption to say, well, why don't we just do DNA testing on all inmates to ascertain whether or not they've been wrongly convicted? What is the short answer to why that just isn't going to work?
Well, the short answer is that the vast majority of cases don't involve DNA evidence. They either don't involve it because of the nature of the case, or they don't involve it because that physical evidence that could generate a DNA profile just no longer exists. So it's, I don't think anybody has an accurate statistic on how many other cases are out there where, you know, there may be something to test, but the primary problem, of course, is that, you know, a lot of this evidence doesn't exist. And there's many, many cases in which there isn't any evidence. There is no DNA evidence.
All right. So when you gave Bernard Webster the news, what was his response? I mean, he had to have been so angry over this.
You know, it's interesting because that's what a lot of people think. I mean, or this is the common assumption. And that actually was not my experience with him at all. He was actually, I have to say, he was really much more patient and calm about this in many ways than I was. His basic response when I told him about this test result was that he had waited 20 years for this.
Mm.
He was overjoyed. He felt finally vindicated. But anger was really, was not his predominant emotion.
That's amazing. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the Innocence Project. I want to talk about the number of wrongly convicted people and how you go about picking and choosing the people that you can work with. Our guest this afternoon is the head of the Innocence Project, the Office of the Maryland Public Defender, and the Chief of Forensics for the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, Michelle Nethercutt. We'll take a short break and then come back here on True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Starrett. If you've got any questions, our local phone number is 503-233-2703 or 1-800-845-2162. We'll be right back.
What ends it be a tragedy to forget the 2002 wildfires? Over 1 million acres in Oregon up in flames. Don't forget. Order the 2003 Endangered West calendar now. Spectacular photos of smoke and fire captured in this wall-sized calendar. Order now. The fierce beauty of the West and the damage done by radical green policies. Call 675-7366. The Endangered West Calendar, just $12. That's 675-7366.
True Talk. Join us for The Single Connection. Sunday nights, 7 till 9 on True Talk 800 AM.
Long before the steel bridge spanned the Willamette River, or the first drinking fountain ever bubbled on a Portland sidewalk, Alvin Rose Dairy was already a local favorite. Today, Alvin Rose Dairy is still a part of Portland, still offering a wide choice of farm-fresh dairy products to help Northwest families enjoy a happy, healthy way of life. And while Alvin Rose Dairy no longer delivers its milk by horse-drawn wagon, one thing remains the same, and that's the Alvin Rose commitment to providing its customers only the freshest dairy products available. The best things in life never change. Alvin Rose, it's fresh, it's family.
This is Tracy Cadenas, fifth generation dairy farmer. You'll find our fresh family of Alvin Rose dairy products at Cup 4 Thriftway.
Today on the Michael Medved Show.
As we approach holiday season, some public schools are more ready to accommodate Islam than Christianity. Next time on the Michael Medved Show.
Listen for Michael Medved, weekdays at 4 on True Talk. Talk radio with a difference. Mary Starrett. True Talk, 800 AM.
For 20 years, Bernard Webster sat in a Maryland prison for a rape he didn't commit. And he was just freed after DNA evidence proved that he didn't do it, but most likely Darren Powell did it, a guy who was just arrested a couple of days ago. Welcome back. I'm Mary Starrett, and you're listening to True Talk 800 AM. Our guest and the woman who is chiefly responsible for getting Bernard Webster not only out of prison but vindicated for this crime is the Chief of Forensics for the Maryland Office of the Public Defender and the head of the Innocence Project for the Office of the Maryland Public Defender, Michelle Nethercutt. We seem to hear more and more of these cases. It seems like not a week goes by or more than two when you don't look in the paper and see one particular person who's been charged and convicted of murder, who, you know, or rape or something, that's been let out of prison after years and years and years. What is going on? Is it simply a matter of the technology available?
Yes, it's partially a function of the technology, because there's technology that exists now that enables you to get in this particular case, very definitive test results, some samples that are extremely small and degraded, and that technological capacity simply did not exist, say, 10 or really even 5 years ago. And I guess the only other factor is that since that there are more people, I mean, there are more people who have taken this issue seriously and are actually pursuing these claims. So it's probably a combination of those two things. It's almost inevitable, I guess, that it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the first five or six of these cases you see, you also begin to see that there's patterns associated with it. So, you know, you can assume that if somebody's looking at cases in New York and finding a number of them, that when someone starts doing the same thing in Mississippi or North Carolina, they're probably going to have the same experience. So there's a little bit of a catch-up effect going on there, that as this issue becomes more widely known in the public, as more people have gotten involved in engaging themselves in taking it seriously, we've seen more of it. And, you know, but it's also, none of this could have happened, obviously, without the technology developing to the point where this kind of testing would be possible.
It's caused me to rethink the death penalty. I used to be a death penalty proponent, but then I hear about all these people who, I mean, these are just the ones we know about. What about over the course of time, these people who were put to death, who spent their lives in prison for something they didn't do?
That whole issue has arisen in Maryland as well, because, of course, Maryland does have a death penalty. The type of offense, Mr. Webster was convicted of a first-degree rape, which in Maryland, first of all, carries a potential life sentence, and often a life sentence is what is imposed in this type of case, a forcible rape involving a weapon or the threat of a weapon is, as remarkable as it sounds, considered himself fortunate in that the judge imposed a term of years, gave him a 30-year sentence as opposed to a life sentence, which is often a very typical sentence. For a conviction for this type of crime. But in Maryland, and particularly in the county in which this crime occurred and in which he was convicted and sentenced, the state attorney there makes very aggressive use of the death penalty. In fact, most of the people on death row in Maryland come from Baltimore County. If this individual who was raped had been killed, that would have been a qualifying capital offense, and I don't think there's much doubt that the state would have pursued, and then there's a very strong possibility, if not probability, that they could very well have gotten a death sentence. So, yes, it's a very serious issue, and this also, Maryland, that you may know, was the state that had, I believe, actually, was the first DNA exoneration of a man by the name of Kirk Bloodsworth, who was originally sentenced to death for a rape murder, and his conviction was overturned. His death sentence was overturned the first time because of finding by the court that the state attorney's office had withheld information about other suspects, and therefore Mr. Bloodsworth had not been able to present that information to the jury, so he got another trial. But he was convicted again and sentenced by a judge to a life term, and then several years after that, the physical evidence was tested, and he was shown not to have been the source of the sperm. So that's someone who spent time on death row and spent, you know, many years in prison as a convicted child murderer. So, yeah, it's a very real issue in Maryland. And, again, you know, this particular case happened in Maryland, but there's no reason to believe that this peculiar set of facts hasn't been replicated throughout the country.
In your experience, and certainly the Public Defender's Office, the head of the Innocence Project, what percentage of cases would you say where someone is wrongly convicted, is it the result of whether it's law enforcement or the prosecutor hiding evidence or out and out lying?
I don't have enough experience, quite honestly, to speak to that issue as it pertains specifically to Maryland, because we just haven't really had enough cases in which we've, conclusively exonerated someone and been able to sort of make a showing of all the factors in that case that led to the conviction. We do know nationwide, I mean, if we look at the, and I think we're now up to 115 exonerations throughout the country. Now, these are just solely exonerations based on DNA evidence, where there was some DNA evidence obtained and tested and found to be probative, or they were factual situations in which the perpetrator of the crime had to be associated with that. So as conclusively proving that this person did not do the crime, well, we've had an opportunity to look at those cases, and the overwhelming factor in those cases, about 70% of them, was mistaken eyewitness identification. Now, following that, there are a series of other things that have happened in these cases involving prosecutorial misconduct, typically the prosecutor not turning over to the defense information that would suggest, would support a claim of innocence, or some type of police misconduct, the use of jailhouse informants, sometimes referred to as snitch witnesses, people who are in prison and are trying to get a deal on pending charges and will testify in exchange for some kind of benefit that the state can confer upon them. The other factors are bad forensic evidence, forensic scientific testing that was not done properly, or there was testing that was done, but the expert witness testified about it in a way that was very misleading, making the evidence seem, you know, much more compelling or important than in fact it was. And then the other factor in there is bad lawyering. Just the lawyers who were kind of asleep at the switch and not doing what they should have been doing to expose some of these problems in the case. So, but of all of those factors, the one that is leading in terms of the recurrence among those 115 cases is mistaken eyewitness identification. So that's a big problem.
The Innocence Project, what is the Innocence Project really all about?
The Innocence Project in Maryland?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is, in 2 years ago, the Maryland legislature passed a law saying that for people convicted of certain types of offenses, and that were basically murders and sex offenses, that if they were able to locate and test DNA evidence that exonerated the person, they could go back into court and have the court undo their conviction. Now, prior to that, even if you were serving a sentence and you located this evidence and it exonerated you, there was a provision in Maryland law that you couldn't challenge your conviction beyond a term of a certain number of years. So the bottom line is the legislature changed the law and said that people had a right to do this. So, although we actually had we were looking into this issue in terms of people who were writing and saying, I didn't do this, and if you can find this evidence and test it, it will show that I didn't. We were looking into those cases. Once the statute went into effect, of course, there was an increased number of these cases, and because we are a statewide agency, and we have a mandate by the legislature to represent people in different types of proceedings, and because of the way the legislature classified this new law, we would be required, at least it would appear to me, under the statute that governs our obligations, we would be required to provide this representation. So that's what we do.
Well, I'm sure Bernard Webster is glad that that's what you do.
Yes, he is.
I want to thank you for being with us, Michelle. These are certainly happy endings to a really sad situation. Now, does he have any kind of does he have any recourse as far as any financial remuneration?
That's an interesting question. He certainly no really obvious and clear source of financial compensation. There is a provision under Maryland law for the state to provide compensation if the governor issues a pardon based on innocence. But, of course, there's a series of hurdles you have to get through there in terms of, you know, getting the governor's attention and getting the governor to agree to a pardon in his situation. It would be it's kind of an interesting question because I don't know what he would be pardoning since his conviction's been vacated. But anyway, if you get through all of those hoops with the governor, there is a provision for the state having the ability or the authority to compensate, but there's no entitlement to it. It's just if they choose to after the governor does this. So the short answer is no. There's certainly no automatic entitlement to any kind of remuneration for this. There has, however, I'm happy to say, there has been really a groundswell of support from the community for Mr. Webster, and people have been actually donating money and furniture and all sorts of things in an effort to help him. And this has just really been an outpouring from people in the community that have read or heard about his situation and have felt compelled to want to assist him.
Well, that's good news for him. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate the work that you do and your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
All righty. We're going to take a short break.